Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Up today, the usual pair of interviews. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, who'll talk about Manning's court-martial and about Edward Snowden. And then, following to the temptations of the cultural turn, we'll talk with Mark Geary, author of a new Kindle single on glam rock about David Bowie and straight male sexuality. First, a few words on a J.P. Morgan paper on reform in the Eurozone, which was written up by Lee Phillips at EUObserver.com. The bank argued that peripheral Europe is still too democratic. The constitutions of Southern Europe were written by anti-fascists, some of them socialists, and too much of that remains. These claims are factually challenged, but the political drift of the Morgan report is clear. More austerity, don't whine, and service debts above all. The first factual challenge is that peripheral Europe has imposed terrific austerity. The second is highlighted by my friend and occasional Behind the News guest, Enrique Diaz-Alvarez, who reports that the Spanish Constitution is a joke. It guarantees the right to dignified, adequate housing and pledges to prevent speculation. Spain had an enormous housing bubble whose bursting had a lot to do with the present euro crisis. The bubble made housing unaffordable for many, especially the young. The Constitution also guarantees the right to a job, but the unemployment rate is 28%, and twice that for youth. But apparently that's not enough for J.P. Morgan. My first guest is Chase Madar. Chase Madar is a civil rights attorney in New York and author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, out in a new edition from Verso, and he's blogging the Manning court-martial for The Nation. Manning faces an almost certain multi-decade-to-life prison sentence for passing along a lot of secret info to WikiLeaks. And if the U.S. government gets its way, it would like to do the same to Edward Snowden, source of the NSA wiretapping leaks. Here's Chase Madar to talk about both. Oh, welcome, Chase. So you've been following the Bradley Manning trial and you've been attending some of it. What's it like down there? What do you see? What do you hear?
Well, the courtroom each day begins in whispers. You have the prosecution team whispering amongst each other. You have the MPs there whispering to each other. And then the defense team comes in with their client, Bradley Manning. This is how I think the Iraq War ends. This trial is properly seen as the last chapter in that whole sorry business, a war that began under a cloak of a lot of state secrecy and distortion and even some lies, ends under a heavy cloak of state secrecy in the trial of a guy who tried to tell the truth about it.
And what exactly are the charges and what penalties does he face for them?
22 charges. He's already pled guilty to the lesser 10 charges, and that's exciting stuff like improper use of a government computer and also passing information to an unauthorized target, WikiLeaks. But the real suspense in this court-martial is the most serious of the 22 charges, aiding the enemy, a capital offense. You don't get more serious than that. Now, Team Obama has made it clear that they're not going to push for the death penalty, but it still does carry a possible life term. There are also a number of charges stemming from the Espionage Act of 1917, which the Obama Department of Justice has been wielding quite frequently against domestic leakers. In fact, twice as often as all previous administrations combined.
And this is a military trial. How does that differ from what a civilian trial?
Military trials, court-martials, are built for speed, and there's a rationale behind that, that in time of war, you need to make these things work quickly. Of course, that rationale has been thoroughly undermined by the fact that Manning has been in prison for 3 years before trial even began. I don't think it makes that much of a difference, though, for the likely outcome, as far as Bradley Manning is concerned, that this is a military trial instead of a federal civilian trial. If you look at how harsh our federal civilian courts have been to anyone charged with even tangentially aiding the enemy with the most tenuous links, they can also be held in solitary for a couple years before they make it to court and then face very heavy penalties. So I think it's too easy to say that it's the military's fault and that if only this were in a civilian court, then he'd be fine or would have a much more lenient sentence.
The feds win, what, 90-95% of the cases?
That's right. Yeah, and that's, you know, higher than the conviction percentage that you had in terror trials in Great Britain at the height of the Troubles.
Well, of course, in many federal but also state trials, plea bargainings are common, right?
Yeah. So that's how the great majority wind out. I'm sure Bradley Manning would be thrilled to take a plea and just cop to the 10 lesser charges, which together carry a maximum penalty of 20 years. We're not talking about a slap on the wrist. But the government has invested so much into the aiding the enemy charge, and the prosecution has it between their teeth. They're not going to let it go.
And am I being too cynical to think that the conclusion is foreordained?
There's no doubt to me, and there hasn't been from the start, that Bradley Manning will face a sentence at the end of this of 40 to 50 years, maybe even more. I think there is a real question whether the aiding the enemy charge, the most serious of the charges, will stick, though. I give it only a 1 out of 3 chance. Of course, even without that, it's a huge penalty, potentially 125 years if you add it all up. And it's all up to the judge in this case, because Bradley Manning has opted to not have a panel that's the military equivalent of a jury try his case.
Do you know why he didn't?
Juries are a little more unpredictable, and I think that may be a gut thing more than anything else. Military juries can deliver wonderful verdicts. Even at Guantanamo, you've had military juries deliver some pretty sane sentences there for people who are only tangentially involved in Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, they can issue really horrible things, too, as they have down at Guantanamo as well.
But some of the military lawyers have actually had attacks of conscience, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. Down at Guantanamo, you have had more members of the prosecution team and prosecution staff quit or act to be transferred than the total number of people who have been convicted there. I don't want to, you know, frame this whole thing as the military is bad and they're out to get Bradley Manning. The military justice system is certainly no worse than our civilian justice system. In some ways, more admirable. They got the ultimate ethical accolade from John Yoo back in the Bush-Cheney time, when John Yoo condemned the whole military justice system for obeying the rule of law too much instead of what Bush and Cheney were telling them to do, ordering them to do. You don't get better than that.
And, of course, we know where the impetus for the prosecution is coming from. It's not coming from the military itself.
That's correct. Although the military does not really cotton to this kind of freewheeling act of conscience so much. But
right, but the executive branch wants.
No, the executive branch.
They want him in jail forever.
Barack Obama's already publicly said, hey, he broke the law when he was interrupted at a gazillion-dollar fundraiser in San Francisco by Bradley Manning, solidarity activist. He broke the law. And
so much for the presumption of innocence.
Yeah, there you go. And that's heavy command interference.
What kind of legal representation does he have?
He has a private lawyer who is very experienced in the military court system and who has also worked at private law, a guy named David Coombs, who has a practice that specializes in people who are defendants in the military court system, but can find the money to get a more focused representation. There is also a team of court-appointed military lawyers who are a member of the JAG Corps. I think they're doing the best job with the hand they've been dealt.
What's the substance of the defense?
Substance of defense, it's a grab bag. Part of it is trying to show that the SCIF, where Bradley Manning was working, that's a sensitive compartmented information facility where the Army Intel Unit is stationed at this base in Iraq, had no discipline as far as information security goes. It was like a freshman dorm atmosphere where people had their passwords written on sticky notes stuck to the telephone, disk drives that were writable and recordable. That's a major no-no in a SCIF. People downloading games, movies, also big no-nos. Everybody knew this there, and nobody enforced it. This was the substance of the day of the court-martial that I caught last week. And the leitmotif, the refrain was always, oh, well, so-and-so had capability to do this to his computer, but not the authority. And the military is very confusing in that they prescribe downloading certain instant message chat programs. They say that's not authorized, but then they will issue information protocols on how you can install them. And what Bradley Manning did, of course, goes beyond that in terms of its boldness, its value. But it still speaks to the point that none of these information security protocols were being enforced in the slightest there.
an enormous number of people had access to the sort of information that he had, right?
That's right. There are 1.4 million people with top secret security clearance now, 400,000 of whom, by the way, are contractors, not direct employees of the government. Just because you have top secret clearance doesn't mean you can get access to all things that are top secret. Usually you just have access to what's in your compartment, and everything else you can only get at if you have a need to know basis for it. However, this barrier is very often only legal, only theoretical, really only on paper, and people can still easily get at other stuff. The Iraqi army, for instance, had access to the SIGACT reports, these field logs from the Iraq war that Bradley Manning leaked. And as we know, the Iraqi army was riddled with a lot of people of uncertain loyalties or mixed loyalties. So it's not like any of this was a life and death matter under heavily guarded lock and key.
Have we learned anything from the trial about Manning as a man or his motivations?
We have learned a lot. I mean, Bradley Manning's motivation has been pretty clearly stated in the instant message dialogue he had with the famous computer hacker Adrian Lamo, who ended up turning him in. So people who have been following this closely from the start haven't been surprised to hear Manning state his motives. But he's someone who is profoundly troubled by the loss of life, particularly the loss of civilian life in Iraq. I don't think this is a post hoc explanation that's convenient now. I think this is what sincerely moved him. He talks about how a military convoy made it back to his base, forward operating base Hammer, and how everyone was happy that they made it back safely because a truck full of Iraqi civilians had gone off to the side of the road to let the military convoy pass, and the Iraqi civilian vehicle had hit an IED and blown up, killing several people. And Bradley Manning had a hard time joining in the celebration there. He really thought that Operation Iraqi Freedom would be about Iraqi freedom and helping people there, not, you know, somewhat callously cheering when it's just civilians who are getting killed. He was also very troubled by one assignment he had in Army Intelligence to look into the arrest of a group of nonviolent Iraqi protesters who were handing out a pamphlet called Where Does the Money Go? That sounds like something you might write, Doug Henwood. And it turns out they were all apprehended. And we know, thanks to Bradley Manning's leaks, that torture continued to be a widespread practice by Iraqi authorities even after Saddam Hussein. I mean, we knew that Americans sometimes did it from the Abu Ghraib photos, but it was still a regular routine practice after our invasion. And it was an official U.S. policy from the Defense Department to do nothing, to turn, you know, just let it be and take notes.
I'm speaking with Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, just out in a new edition from Verso. And well, there was also some talk, particularly when this first broke, that he was a troubled man. Like, you know, he had personality problems, which, of course, totally marginalizes any principled reason he might have had for doing this. But have we learned anything about his personality or any of those issues?
Well, he comes across in court as a very poised, very thoughtful, plainly spoken young man. He comes across as, a very sober-minded, ethical, and responsible human being, perhaps too much so for the U.S. military or for the kind of large government institution he was working in. It is, of course, true that any whistleblower or dissenter or naysayer in any field, whether it's the U.S. military or the Soviet nuclear physics program, who steps out of line and who speaks out of turn will be smeared as a crazy person. This is how whistleblowers are pathologized. Their political motives are usually tamped down and obscured by charges of being a nutbag or crazy, or that it's a sexual motive because Bradley Manning is gay. This is why Richard Nixon sent his goons to break into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office 40 years ago. They were really eager to air whatever dirty stuff they could find there. But of course, being Nixon's totally incompetent goons, they couldn't find the files. They never did, and that was that. Team Obama's a lot smarter, and that's unfortunate for Bradley Manning.
Do you have any sense of whether Manning expected this kind of treatment?
I think he expected to get away with it. And he absolutely would have had he not really opened his heart to this guy he met online, Adrian Lamo, a famous computer hacker with great skills, who, to those of us who aren't part of that hacktivist and hacking subculture, seems to match the profile of so many other police informants. He's a convicted felon with a history of mental illness who was involuntarily committed just 3 or 4 weeks before Bradley Manning contacted him. And I don't mean to make him out as a big villain or the Iago of this play, because I don't think he's really interesting enough. I think he went to the feds after the first day of his 5-6 day conversation with Bradley Manning just to cover his own behind.
How'd they get hooked up?
Adrian Lamo has a certain high profile. I mean, he's very well known among a lot of techie people, people who work in information security, because he's someone who famously foiled it and hacked into the New York Times. And Bradley Manning approached him.
Okay, let's shift to another now, leaker. In the last few weeks, there's a new name, Edward Snowden. What do you make of him?
I think his leak is entirely for the good. It has sparked an important national debate. We'll see if this national debate leads to any real change. But what the NSA is doing is something that a majority of Americans are very uncomfortable with. Now, the story is still evolving. We don't know the exact depths or the scope of this NSA surveillance and their data dragnets. But it seems even in the mildest, most cautious estimate of what they're really doing to, even if it doesn't violate our current sorry state of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence about illegal searches and seizures, it's still profoundly troubling. And this idea that metadata, just the information of who you're calling and for how long and how often, that's not significant and therefore no big deal, that is completely false. There's nothing meta about metadata, and you can know so much about someone by knowing who they're calling for how long and how often. And this is information that's been used against other whistleblowers. I sat on a panel with former NSA analyst Thomas Drake, and he got put through the ringer. They used his metadata. Ditto for Jesselyn Radack, a whistleblower from the Bush-Cheney Department of Justice. So we need to really disabuse ourselves of this notion that this is no big deal. And I strongly take issue with people like David Simon, the guy who created the Wire TV show, who is... His response has been to puff out his chest and say, oh, well, it's no big deal. This is how the Baltimore Police Department treats suspected drug dealers. So what's the big deal if Washington treats everyone in the country like this? Well, I think it's a very big deal and a very big difference. And I think the way Simon has been strutting around saying it's no big deal, is he seems like a very territorial little guy. He's upset that other people are, you know, learning about, writing about what he put in his TV show.
But if you don't have, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to worry about, right?
Yeah, that's the most depressing refrain of all of this. There's a great Twitter feed, Nothing to Hide, where people are earnestly saying this. Oh, well, I have nothing to hide. The New York Times columnist Gail Collins had a wonderful piece a few days ago where she really took this issue head on. And found an example of a man, a family, that had absolutely nothing to hide, but they realized they had everything to fear if their data gets put in the wrong hands, if there's overzealous law enforcement coupled with overweening surveillance. This is a lawyer by the name of Brandon Mayfield. He lives in the Pacific Northwest. He married an Egyptian woman. He converted to Islam. There are plenty of Muslim Americans. That's not a crime. And the FBI erroneously matched his fingerprint. His fingerprint was in the database because he had served honorably in the U.S. military. The FBI erroneously matched his fingerprint with fingerprints found on fragments from the Madrid bombing of 2004. And even though this guy had never set foot in Spain in his life, his house was raided, he was arrested, and his daughter's Spanish class homework was adduced as evidence that he was in cahoots with Spanish terrorists. And it's only thanks to the Spanish authorities, who loudly protested, saying, no, this is the wrong guy. We actually found someone with the real fingerprint match. So, you know, fingerprints are supposed to be scientific, foolproof. They aren't, and neither is any of this other surveillance data. I mean, just because something is high-tech doesn't mean there's a real margin for human error here, and that's what it gets down to.
Also, there's the channel Michel Foucault for a moment. Like, being observed changes the way people act. The suspicion you're being observed is going to change the way people act.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think our government needs to work so hard to prove all the Foucauldians right about the panopticon and all that. And all the dystopian young adult science fiction names they have for these systems, too. Echelon and it's too much. So this is a good thing that this has come out. I think Edward Snowden has launched something very important. Now, why exactly he chose Hong Kong, I don't know if that was really the best choice. He may come to regret that. But I certainly think he did the right thing. And the fact that the origins of all this government surveillance were quasi-legal and started in a legitimate open debate but then quickly moved into a confidential debate, that does not mean that it's okay. And I think everyone should lose the idea that just because something is legally permissible, it must therefore be a good thing. It is legal for anyone to have unprotected sex with a house full of heroin addicts. That's not prescribed by the law. Or to liquidate your assets and give all the money to Sarah Palin's political action committee. You know, that's legal too. There are any number of choices that we're met with every day that are legally permissible but incredibly foolish, destructive, and wrong. And that's not the only criterion here for extreme government surveillance.
It's been amazing to hear some Democrats say it's okay because they trust Obama. If it were Bush, they wouldn't necessarily trust, but, you know, it's not Cheney. It's our man Obama.
Oh, yeah, and Obama was at pains to remind everyone that he is not Cheney. It weren't though his exact words in his interview with Charlie Rose. This is so short-sighted. I mean, we're talking about a structure that is going to be in place. The Democrats are not going to hold the White House forever. That's just a fact. So what's also encouraging, though, Doug, is that some Republicans are speaking out against this. And I really hope the Rand Pauls and the Ron Pauls of the world learn to cooperate with civil libertarians who are to the left of center or who are at least in the Democratic column, like Senators Ron Wyden and Mark Udall. I think it's critical that we get some bipartisanship going the other direction against this surveillance, against this overkill on the war on terror that has been such a failure.
And finally, when last we talked, when your book came out, you said you doubted the political efficacy of leaks, that they don't really change anything. Do you still think that?
I have to qualify that. It would be entirely dishonest for me to say leaks are all you need. Once people have information, they will make the right choice. That's naive, and history bears that out. That's true of nation states. We know that's true of individuals, too. I mean, we all know plenty of people who know what they should do but still do the opposite. But we have seen real-world effects. Good effects come from Bradley Manning's leaks. The Tunisian uprising. I'm not going to say that Bradley Manning's leaks caused that, but they played a small, significant, and quite noble role there. Perhaps more importantly for Americans, they did help us withdraw our last troops from Iraq. And that's very important. The Iraq war logs may not have made such an impact in the United States, but when the raw facts of our Iraq war came out over there, they really pissed off a lot of people, inflamed Iraqi public opinion, and they made it impossible for the Iraqi government to renew legal immunity for American troops deployed to Iraq. And without legal immunity granted by the host government in Iraq, there was no way that our troops could stay there. And that's one of the reasons why Obama was forced to comply with his campaign promise to get the troops out of Iraq. And that's entirely to the good.
And what do you think is going to happen to Snowden?
That's hard to say. It could be a long stalemate with just like Assange being holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Snowden may spend a good several years in Hong Kong. The fact that China is a great power makes it very difficult for the U.S. to just shove him in a black bag and throw him in the cargo hold of an airplane. So that is very unlikely. But the Beijing has authoritarian instincts of their own, and they may want to tamp down on him or make a little gift of him. On the other hand, they may enjoy having a political exile from the U.S. where they can lord it over and scold Washington for human rights abuses for a change. I think they might find that altogether delicious.
I was Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, just out from Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Television man is crazy, Sam with juvenile delinquent wreck. Oh, man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh, brother, you guess I'm a dude that.
Oh, young dude.
Hey, dude.
Harry the dude.
Where are you?
That was some of All the Young Dudes, a David Bowie song performed by Mock the Hoople something like 40 years ago. The song and glam culture is the subject of my next guest, Kindle Single, published by Boing Boing, and Smart Geary, author of All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Matters. This sort of thing is off the usual Behind the News beat, but hey, the Financial Times writes about culture. I love this music when it came out and still do, and sexuality is important, fun to talk about, and Mark does it very well. Mark Geary.
You mentioned the gay angle, but the sexuality of glam. Pretended to be gay, but mostly straight, right?
Well, I describe Bowie as sort of a reverse transvestite in a way. He's a heteroflexible or metrosexual, or the cutesy terms we use these days, an almost entirely straight man who may have had the occasional gay affair way back in the day, but who is, for all intents and purposes, straight. I mean, every biography on the groaning shelf, you know, sagging under the weight of Bowie biographies, all of which I've read, and that's why I have a self-granted PhD in Bowie studies. But all of them are universally in accord on the point that everybody who toured with Bowie saw him swatting away, apoplectic gays and transvestites who were trying to insinuate themselves into his hotel room, and meanwhile, sleek young would-be plaster casters are immediately admitted to the sanctum, and then the door closes to the heart-rending moans of all the flaming young things who had hoped to dive into Day's hot tub. So there really isn't much biographical evidence to suggest that Bowie ever had many flings. He probably dipped his toe in those waters at one point or another, but you know, the famous anecdote about finding him in bed with Mick Jagger, that seems to have been largely a concoction by Angie Bowie as a way of ginning up media interest at that time. He lived with Ken Pitt, his first manager, and strolled around the apartment that he shared with Ken Pitt in a kind of a sugar daddy-like relationship. Pitt was a really pivotal figure in Bowie's life, mentoring him and doing a kind of Eliza Doolittle-like Pygmalion transformation, schooling Bowie in Aubrey Beardsley and Oscar Wilde's Little Prince and Other Tales and The Yellow Book and Tiffany Glass. He was a gay man, much older than Bowie, highly aesthetically literate, wise in the ways of London antique shops and so forth. But the sexuality that Bowie becomes a purveyor of is a fascinating thing, and at the risk of sounding pretentious, it's really peculiarly Derridean because it's always deferring meaning. It's sort of this ceaseless circulatory chain of signification. And what I found spellbinding as a teen was the ways in which Bowie aroused these feelings for which there was no name and to a degree still is no name. In my essay, the Kindle ebook that Boing Boing just published as its inaugural outing as a publishing imprint, All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Matters, I quote Simon Frith, the British music critic, who talks about this bizarre, almost not ineffable, but sort of inexpressible or un-Englishable, very peculiar emotion he experiences while watching Depeche Mode in the 80s. And he says, I, a middle-aged, presumably straight man, had the peculiar sensation of watching this androgynous ephebe of a kind of a marmoreal young man, you know, that marble-like English pallor, round-shouldered, exquisitely womanly, and he's wearing a dress, this young lad playing the synthesizer in concert. And Frith talks about breathlessly watching and hoping his shoulder strap would slip off throughout the entire concert, and it's always just on the verge of slipping off, so he could see what? You know, a boyish nipple? And I remember at the age of about 14 experiencing something like that sensation, always having been straight, and for my entire sexual life, going forward, ending up straight, but seeing the 1980 floor show, The Last Gasp of Ziggy, where Bowie performed at the Marquee Club in London, taped after the Spiders had broken up, but with Mick Ronson still on guitar and a whole cavalcade, as they like to say, of guest stars, including Marianne Faithfull, in a nun's habit singing I've Got You, Babe, in a duet with Bowie. But Bowie at one point wears this exquisite sheath dress-like outfit, and his nipples are exposed. And I remember finding that peculiarly arousing. And the feelings it arouses are, because adolescence is a protean period, when sexuality is sort of indeterminate, when gender is kind of deliquescing, and it's starting to solidify, the mold is starting to harden, you're deciding what you want to be. But you're in that Ganymede-like, ephebe-like moment where gender and sexuality are still sort of liquescent. You feel these conflicting feelings. You're aroused by a man who looks womanly, so presumably that's a heterosexual response. You're responding to the feminine in him, yet you're aware that he's male. So are you gay? And yet you're identifying with him. So does that mean you want to be a woman? Or that that image strikes a responsive chord deep in your sexual unconscious that has to do with these sort of unresolved feminine elements in every man, and never more so than when you're an adolescent male? Or are you also responding to Bowie's undeniable machismo? He pulls off this bizarre thing, which is he makes effeminacy and androgyny macho. In other words, he's always the alpha male, even when he's at his most feminine. Because Bowie in that period is often feminine and always androgynous, but never camp. And that's a crucial distinction. He's never a simpering, limp-wristed, Liberace-like, Paul Lynde-like character, like the pantomime dames in English music hall that he must have seen, and like the camping it up tradition in English comedy, which was all over the telly in those days, and which he must also have seen, making queerness into sort of a hateful figure of fun. Bowie is never about that. He is never camp. He's ironic in a postmodern sense, in the sense that he creates a Warholian plastic pop star, a knowing pop star, an arch pop star who's winking at the transaction between fan and idol. But as he says, Nijinsky and Woolworths, a bit of each of those go into making the Ziggy figure. So anyway, I find all those roiling, unresolved, turbulent sexual thoughts that Bowie arouses, because they are both gonadal and intellectual, and that's another sort of dialectic that's going on in there. I find the attempt to detangle that hairball really intriguing, and I'm still at it, obviously.
Now, we've been speaking almost entirely about Bowie, but the subject of the Kindle single is Mott the Hoople and their version of a Bowie song, All the Young Dudes. Dude, first of all, let's talk about the word dude.
It's not so much about Mott the Hoople as it is about that song written by Bowie, but really owned by Mott, as I say, as the glam anthem. And so I refract through the prism of that song the question of the transgressive possibilities of rebellion through style, really, in a Dick Hebdigian subcultural studies sense.
But you have a passage where you analyze the word dude, its origins and meaning. So I think people think of, you know, dude, the frat boy dude. That's not what it was originally.
You're absolutely right. And that, to me, is a really fascinating etymological Darwinian evolution, because dude at this moment, if you take a really obnoxious, as New Yorkers would say, up-in-your-grill example of it, there's the phrase coined by the Time magazine food critic Josh Ozersky, dude food, which is for bloviating, high-fiving, Don Ed Hardy, Harley Davidson style professional gluttons like Guy Fieri and Adam Richman on the Food Channel. What those guys are all about is grotesque, guilt-free gluttony, but it's very dude-ocentric. As Ozersky told me when I interviewed him about that usage of dude, they're guys. You know, they wear bowling shirts with 1950s Don Ed Hardy flame striping. They eat their body weight in White Castle burgers. They wear their Ray-Bans backwards on their heads. They're as bodacious and obnoxious and imperishably vulgarian as guys can be at their most guyish. So that's sort of the apotheosis of the testosterone-addled, four-on-the-floor dude in its current incarnation. Now, move the needle a little bit back on the time-traveling chronometer, and we arrive at probably the best-known instantiation or incarnation of dudeness, which is the dude in The Big Lebowski, which is a slightly more, I hesitate to say feminine, but a slightly less hyperbolically gonadal, balls that clang, macho use of the term dude. And that dude is a go with the flow. It's sort of the zen of surfer hippie consciousness, walking on sunshine, preferably blotter acid sunshine. You know, nothing touches me. It's sort of the moment where Lao Tzu meets, you know, Mr. Zigzag and Dr. Zog's sex wax. You know, it's very 70s, and it sort of channels the dudeness of 60s masculinity, imperturbably mellow. But the original historical roots of dude are joined at the hip with the wildy and aesthete. The word arrives on the historical stage in the late 19th century and is associated inextricably with the dandy, the gentleman with the green carnation in his waistcoat, the elaborately tied ascot, diamond stick pins, the sword cane, the boulevardier, the flaneur, the idler, right? And very suspect in terms of masculinity. The connotations are queer. The dude is posing as a catamite, posing as a sodomite, or at least suspected of that from the very beginning. So the dude is a fop. It's any man overly concerned with sartorial flair, with social delicacy, and also with verbal eloquence. And then there's this funny kind of ping-pong match, or this sort of bitch-slap fest that goes on between who will be tarred with dudeness. So the Brits accuse Americans of being dudish and of coining the term. American newspapers in New York, shortly after Oscar Wilde's arrival on his triumphal tour, and I make the point in the essay that Wilde is the Ziggy Stardust of the late 19th century, you know, as a Warholian media manipulator, as an unparalleled, incomparable master of the quotable zinger, he is Bowie avant la lettre, or turn it around, and Bowie is clearly a careful student and a quick study of Wilde and his use of public persona as a new Warholian art form. But dudeness comes to America. The vector of transmission is very clearly Oscar Wilde. And there are all these newspaper cartoons and joking carte de visite and cartoons on popular products and advertising and packaging that send up the idea of this sylphing, simpering, pomaded, overly perfumed, sexually questionable, gender plastic character, the dude. When Bowie appropriates the term dude, it's unclear as to whether or not he's aware of its historical reverberations, although I believe that as a student of Wilde and Aubrey Beardsley and the Bloomsbury group, he at least absorbed that intuitively or unconsciously. But Bowie was nothing if not a recovering hippie, and Ziggy Stardust is sort of barnacled over with all of this hippie jargon. So at the same time that he's trying to appropriate the Nadsat locutions of Clockwork Orange, which he had just seen, so in Suffragette City you get, oh, droogie, don't crash here, there's all this hippie lingo left over from his art school days and his performance art days and his free festival days on the Space Oddity record. And they make very peculiar bedfellows, I must say.
I want to relate to you.
I'm speaking with Mark Deary, author of All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Matters, published by Boing Boing as a Kindle single.
Then that song, of course, became famous through Ian Hunter, who was not quite the explorer of class and androgyny that Bowie was. What do you make of that?
Well, one thing that occurs to me immediately is the ways in which these pop artifacts, you know, these artifacts of commercial culture, which are to say a pop song, these products of, you know, what we don't need Adorno and Horkheimer to tell us are the culture industry. I'm always fascinated by the popular reception of these things and the either unintentional or willfully perverse or intentionally subversive or at the very least inescapably idiosyncratic readings of things that people have in fan culture. And, you know, I'm very much convinced by the cultural studies school of thought and Dick Hebdige and people like that who look at culture as a conversation. And again, to teeter on the brink of pretentiousness, sort of in Claude Shannon's information terms, which is that Adorno and Horkheimer fetishize the transmission tower, you know, beeping out its Telstar-like signals to mass culture. They don't pay, you know, in the cultural studies school of thought's belief, nearly enough attention to the receiver on the other end of that line of transmission. And Marxism is thoughtful, obviously, about, you know, the arterial network, the capillaries, the delivery system, the system of distribution throughout culture. Now, I think it's possible to fetishize rituals of resistance, you know, and see transgression that will bring Archer Daniels Midland to its knees in the pornographic rewritten Star Trek narratives of Nebraskan housewives, and I think that's a great mistake. I mean, you can make a fetish of rebellion through ritual too, just as you can overly fetishize the Orwellian dominance of the culture industry. But to your question about Ian Hunter and that song, what's fascinating is what makes that song is that Bowie writes it as a sardonic eulogy, a sort of dismissal of the 60s. And the great telling political line on that in that song is the protagonist is singing about his older brother who's still upstairs with his Beatles and his Stones. We never got it off on that revolution stuff. Too many snags. What a drag. So the wave of the 60s and all the utopian dreams of the 60s has broken and receded and left its scummy residue on this sort of Neville Shudian science fictional beach of the 70s. And gas rationing is just around the corner, the stock market crash, unrest in the Middle East. The Manson family has had its moment in Los Angeles. Altamont is still reverberating in everyone's minds. So it's really important to remember that glam happens against that backdrop. And Bowie writes this as sort of a wreath of ironic plastic flowers at the grave of 60s political dreams. Now begins the 70s, when the revolution will happen within your cranial vault. It will be an idiosyncratic personal revolution, a revolution of gay bathhouses and polysexual communes like Sandstone and Topanga Canyon. But Ian Hunter takes the song, and he's a pub-crawling proletarian. Mott the Hoople are laddish. They're just plain folks. They're blue denim guys, unlike Bowie. They're the furthest thing from aesthetes. And they apparently had this moment in their shows where they would dare a catcaller's buddies to drag him down from the cheap seats, and then they would pour beer over him when the friends dragged him down to the lip of the stage. So Ian Hunter, in the recording of the Bowie song, improvises entirely extempore. Does this rap at the end in which he calls out an imaginary catcaller in the cheap seats and says, "Bring him down here, bring him down here. I've been waiting for this all night long," and he's going to settle the score. Cameron Crowe, reviewing this record as a teenager for Rolling Stone, says, "This is clearly the most horrifying example of gay gang rape ever committed to vinyl." So he reads this incredible subtext in this perfectly innocuous goofball rap at the end of the recording. And other people have heard all manner of things.
Finally, since we're running over on time, what were the lingering effects, the lasting effects on male sexuality of the glam moment? Were there any?
It's a vexed question, and one that really bedevils me, and that I keep worrying over and over, and that I'll probably return to in other essays. And it's essentially unanswered, but one thing is immediately clear to me, that utopian beachhead, a beachhead having been secured by a utopian subculture, can be lost. You know, they said of Situationism that it was the brief passage of a few people through a moment of time. And glam really feels like that. And the amazing thing about it that I feel is worth remarking upon is twofold. One, it's often dismissed as rebellion through style. And as I hope I've been thoughtful about in the course of our interview, there is this thing called cultural politics, which is not politics qua politics inside the Beltway done in Senate subcommittees, nor is it sober-minded resolutions at Port Huron. But there is also this thing that happens among lonely teenagers in their bedrooms staring at reliquaries made out of photos of David Bowie torn from Cream magazine. Politics assumes many guises. And so, to me, one of the extraordinary things about glam is that it was a revolution of sort of a rethinking of straight masculinity, and that doesn't seem to have been remarked upon. While the great movements of that moment unquestionably were feminism and the struggle for gay liberation, and I'm not for an instant suggesting that glam rock, this ridiculous subculture in a pink feather boa, was as culturally profound as feminism or gay rights, the ways in which it borrowed everything from but the burden from gay culture, a not unproblematic gesture, I'm at pains to point out. And many queer theorists have problems with what they call Queer David, his light-fingered appropriation of sort of the glittery pelt of gayness and a sort of aestheticized otherworldly vision of the gay as this polysexual alien. And then Bowie's commercialization of that and the way in which he sold it back to straight, largely white guys in bedroom communities, that's problematic, I agree. And Oscar Wilde did the same thing with the French decadence of Ouisman and La Ba, and Dorian Gray is essentially sort of a normatized middle-brow version of true, hardcore French decadence. But still in all, inhabiting that skin changed straight men like myself irrevocably and made us understand the ways in which sexuality and gender are performed, that even straight masculinity is a form of drag. And bear in mind, this is, you know, a decade before Judith Butler, and a kid with a Ziggy mullet you know, marooned in the asteroid belt of San Diego, doesn't have a clue yet about Judith Butler or Luce Irigaray or Monique Wittig or French feminism. But he gets this weird welter of feelings that seeing a man in a dress with one nipple showing arouses. And so I think that really did do something to masculinity. What I regret is that we seem to have lost so much ground, that now we live in the age of a sort of a strenuous dudeness and that sense of being able to occupy various positions on the masculine spectrum seems somehow to have receded in the historical rearview mirror. And as an aging glam rocker, I regret that.
That was Mark Deary, author of All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Matters, published by Boing Boing as a Kindle single. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of the 1973 duet that Mark Deary mentioned between David Bowie and Marianne Faithfull, doing I Got You, Babe. You can find it on YouTube. Till next week, bye.
Until we go,
I don't know if all that's true, but you've got me, baby, I've got you,
babe,
I've got you, babe. Turns out money's always spent.
I guess that's so we don't have a lot, but at least I'm sure.